Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is George Lakoff, whose latest book is Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. Earlier books include Moral Politics, How Liberals and Conservatives Think, and Don't Think of an Elephant. George Lakoff is a cognitive linguist. He's been on KPFA several times. He talks about framing, political framing in particular, metaphor, the use of metaphor in our thoughts and our processes, and we'll go into the idea of framing a little bit later, but let's first talk about Whose Freedom and the reason for the book. It strikes me that what you're trying to say here is that it's not merely that conservatives lie about the use of freedom, it's that the definitions, how we define freedom, and it's even deeper perhaps than defining between a liberal or progressive and a conservative or a right-winger, they're different.
Well, yes and no. Freedom is what's called a contested concept in my business, and we study those things. Contested concepts are concepts like art, where everybody has necessarily a different idea about what constitutes art. And the same is true of freedom. People are going to have different ideas about what the very concept of freedom is. But one thing we do know about contested concepts is that they have a structure. And the structure includes an uncontested core. That is a part of the meaning of freedom or art. It's the same for everybody. Then the question is, given that core of cases, what is it that expands it to the other cases? And what W.B. Gully discovered back in 1957 is that there's a core, that the core has a structure, and that there are values that apply to that structure and extend it to different meanings. And the values in this case are the values behind conservative and liberal thought. They are what I called in the book Moral Politics, the strict father and nurturing parent model, which are models of the family that then structure conservative thought and liberal thought. And once you apply those to the core notion of freedom, you get two utterly different views of what freedom is. That's the basic idea of the book. It came about as a result of George Bush's second inaugural address, which is, you know, analyzed in great detail at the end, where for part of the address, Bush used the uncontested core. It sounded like he was talking just like Roosevelt would or Kennedy or somebody like that or Martin Luther King. And then all of a sudden, he has a certain sentence in there, and from then on, it's conservative freedom and not liberal freedom.
A lot of people put that in terms of the phrasing that's used is coded messages to his base, but that's not what's going on.
Not at all what's going on. If you're progressive, you have certain problems with Bush. You say, how could he, you know, lock up hundreds of people in Guantanamo with no due process in the name of freedom? How can he torture people in the name of freedom? How can he spy on millions of Americans in the name of freedom? You know, isn't he going against the very idea of freedom? And what's most scary is that he has a different idea of what constitutes freedom, and it's absolutely consistent. It comes directly out of normal conservative thought, and it is, you know, completely foreign to progressives.
Something still strikes me, which is that not the followers, the conservative followers, but the leaders also lie, and they're corrupt, and they're not particularly honorable.
That's right.
And the question is, how does that element play into these two views?
Well, first of all, I have no doubt that the leaders absolutely believe the worldview they have, that they have a conservative view of the world, that they believe that that worldview says that they're acting morally, and that even when they're lying in a good cause. They're fighting evil. And if they're good fighting evil, you may have to use the devil's own tools against them. That's justified. So I have no doubt that they are, quote-unquote, sincere in their worldview.
But what about K Street, though?
K Street's another matter. That has to do with greed. And certain forms of greed fit that worldview, and other forms don't. I mean, there are lobbyists, you know, the lobbyists for ACLU are not on K, you know, are not getting through.
Well, when we're talking about frames, which is this deepest concept, something that's buried within us, right? And people, I guess, just somehow activate these frames. Would you say that's more or less what's going on?
That's right. We think in terms of frames. You can't not think in terms of the, and it's not just politics. Anything at all. You have the concept of a cup. You know what a cup is. It has an image in your head. There's a container. It can fit in your hand. It can hold a fluid. You can drink out of it. It may have a handle or not, and that's about all you know about a cup. You know, it can be made of plastic, paper, ceramic, metal, and that's about it. You don't know anything more, but that's a frame for a cup, and that's how we think. And you say the word cup, and that knowledge comes up automatically. It's activated. The same is true of cut and run, tax relief, whatever.
Now, when you're talking about the cup, let's say, I don't want to get too far afield in philosophy, but these concepts go back how we judge what a cup is. We have the Platonic ideal of cup. That goes back to Greece. I mean, we've been examining these sorts of issues. What is the difference between what George Lakoff and the other cognitive linguists are doing and these philosophers who have been trying to investigate the meaning of language, ranging again from Plato and Aristotle all the way to Wittgenstein and past?
Right. Cognitive science has shown that most of those ideas are not correct.
Okay.
That if you look at Plato, you have a notion of, you know, a Platonic ideal of cup defined by necessary and sufficient conditions, giving the essence of a cup. The essence of a cup is abstract. If you go to Aristotle, the essence of a cup is in the world, but again, given by necessary and sufficient conditions. And there are no variations on any of these things, and that's true, supposedly, of everything. Turns out thought doesn't work that way. And the world doesn't work that way. Neither works that way. And that's one of the things we find in cognitive science. Most thought is not conscious. Most thought does not work via standard formal logic or anything like that. There is a logic of frames. There's a logic of metaphors. We know how those things work. They're very, very different from standard, classical Aristotelian logic. The idea of rationalism, that we all think the same way, that we have the same idea of reason, that therefore if you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion, that's false. Because we think in terms of frames, because we think in terms of metaphors, it turns out not everybody has the same frames and the same metaphors, and they're very different. And those frames and metaphors are physically in your brain. The old view from Descartes in rationalism was that the mind was abstract, not physical, a different kind of substance. It's false. The mind is the brain. The brain is physical. Every single bit of knowledge that you have, whether it's about a concept or a word or a fact in the world, is physically in the synapses of your brain. At our lab, where we study neural computation at Berkeley, we know a lot about the kinds of neural computations needed to characterize different kinds of concepts. We've been working at that for almost 20 years now, and we found out a lot about it. But when these concepts are in your brain, they define common sense. They're the normal way you think. And if the facts don't fit what's in your brain, the brain doesn't change, the facts are ignored.
People have kind of come around to that from different angles. There's a writer named Robert Olin Butler, who I interviewed, who said that it was his understanding that since you can't convince someone about politics, if you're writing fiction, you can kind of get in the back door.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I think writing fiction is good about that because it allows you, in writing fiction, to empathize with a character and to get inside that character's head. What's particularly interesting about the kind of work I do, especially the neural characterization of it, is that our brains allow us to have mutually contradictory views of the world at the same time, but not being used simultaneously, but where each mutually inhibits the other. And these strict father, nurture, and parent models that define conservative and liberal views of the world are like that. We all have both models, and we all know them, but we may not use them actively. So if you are a complete progressive in every part of your life, but you can walk into Rambo and understand it, you have a strict father model. There's no question. And if you are a complete conservative in every part of your life and you can turn on the TV and see the Bill Cosby show and understand it, you have a nurturant parent model. Now, the point of that is that there are a lot of people in the country, so-called center, who have both models in different parts of their lives. And what we've been studying recently is the systematicity of that. And there's some really interesting findings there. It appears that there are people who will self-identify as conservatives, but actually have progressive ideas, progressive values in many parts of their lives. For example, there are people who are conservative who love the land. You know, they're hunters or fishermen. They love to eat their fish. They like to go hiking or camping with their kids. They think the land is beautiful and they love it. That's one of the reasons Schweitzer won in Montana. He plugged into that. There are plenty of people who identify as conservatives who want to live in progressive communities where there are leaders who care about them and people care about each other and take care of each other and do community service. That's a very common situation. There are people who self-identify as conservatives who are progressive Christians, who really do believe in turning the other cheek, who really do believe in helping the poor and the downtrodden. And there are people who self-identify as conservative who are civil libertarians. That is, they really believe in the same thing that ACLU believes in, but they would never join ACLU. They just happen to believe in the same things. And the same is true with business people. There are a lot of, especially small businessmen throughout a red America, who will call themselves conservatives, but they're honest. They treat their employees well. They would never pollute or harm the public and so on. Now, those are progressive business people. And if you put that together, what you find is that there are a lot of people in America who will be progressive about certain areas of their lives that are really important to them, but call themselves conservatives and actually be conservatives in other areas of their lives. And progressives have not been talking to them. They haven't been activating the progressive parts of their brain.
The book like Moral Politics, or your books on metaphors, we live by all that, is about research and how we're mapping how people think and how they feel and how all that corresponds with each other. When you're talking about a book like Don't Think of an Elephant or Whose Freedom, though, and you're focusing specifically on what progressives do, then in that sense, we're talking in a way about window dressing, aren't we? I mean, it's a different process.
It's the opposite. We're not talking about window dressing in any way at all, in either book. The language you use, any language, comes with frames. And they are what I'll call surface frames. That is, they're frames that fit the words.
Okay, let me ask you this. When you're using the word frame, are you talking about a framework? Are you talking about a window frame?
No. I'm actually taking the language from cognitive science, particularly from researchers in linguistics and sociology, Charles Fillmore in linguistics and Irving Goffman in sociology. They actually both came to the same conclusions in the same city at the same time, which is Berkeley, but for very different reasons and studying different things. And let me try to give you a sense of Goffman's ideas. Goffman studied institutions. He would go and work in an insane asylum. He worked as a croupier in Las Vegas. He did his field work by actually immersing himself in an institution and being part of it. And he found out something very interesting. He used the metaphor of life as a play, that people who worked, let's say, in insane asylums or in Las Vegas would adopt certain personas. They would play certain roles in these things. Just think of an ordinary hospital, for example. You have surgeons, you have nurses, you have doctors, you have orderlies, patients, visitors, and so on. And they all know how to act, how to dress, what to do. You know, the surgeons don't come in wearing shorts and flip-flop, but the visitors can. Is there certain relationships? There's hierarchical structure. The doctors perform the operations. They don't perform it, downstairs at the reception desk. there's a certain set of constraints defining these things. And those Goffman called frames. They are knowledge structures that we have about institutions and how to function in the institution and how you may be one way at home, you go into the hospital and you're a different way. Or you go into Las Vegas and you become a croupier and you're another person. And that's very normal. That's how social institutions work. Fillmore discovered essentially the same thing, but just by looking at words. If you take a word like accuse, you have an accuser, an accused person, a crime, etc. And that's presupposed to be a bad thing. And you're saying that somebody did that bad thing and so on. There's a structure to the word accuse. And there's only a certain roles. There's a role of an accuser, a role of an accused, etc. Now, he and Goffman came to the same conclusion for totally different reasons. And other people have found basically that this is, in fact, how the mind works. We think in terms of these frames. So the frames are in the conceptual system. They're not in words and so on. Now, when a frame fits a word or an expression, let's call that a surface frame, like tax relief or the death tax. In order for that to make sense, you have to have a set of what I'll call deep frames, that is, values and principles. And for the past 40 years, the conservatives have been putting out their views on what taxation is. Taxation is taking money out of your pocket, it's stealing it, et cetera. The liberals are tax and spend liberals, et cetera. Now, they have said that over and over, and they've talked about the market. They've talked about how taxation is draining the market, how regulation is draining the market, how anybody can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They have a set of principles, and they have a strict father morality that shows up actually in their child-rearing programs and focus on the family. It's literally there in raising families. And they have a system that fits together. They've been putting it out there for years. And once it's there in place, the death tax makes sense. Tax relief makes sense. If you haven't been putting your ideas out there and your values out there for years, you can't just make up a little phrase and have it make sense. It doesn't work that way. You've got to repeat your values over and over for a long time before they change. Now, the good news for liberals is that most of these values are unconscious. And let me give you, you might say, well, what do you mean by an unconscious principle? How could you have a principle that's unconscious? Let me give you an example of this. Take the issue of taxation. Back in the days of the colonies, you know, after the Revolution, and even before the Revolution, they had the idea of putting the Commonwealth together, not just to pay the king as a traditional tax, but for the common good.
You focus, in fact, in Whose Freedom, George Lakoff, on the Commonwealth specifically.
Exactly. You put together the Commonwealth for the common good. What do you do with it? You build an infrastructure that each person can use and needs. You build roads, public buildings, schools, hospitals. You also, today, you've built, with taxpayer money, we built the Internet, we built the satellite system, and we have a banking system supported by taxpayer money. The SEC holds up the stock market. The court system is taxpayer money enforcing contracts. Nobody can run a business without getting bank loans, having stocks, you know, enforcing contracts, using roads, using communications. They all use the Commonwealth. And nobody can fulfill their individual goals unless they use the Commonwealth for the common good. It's not a sacrifice to work for the common good. It is necessary for each individual. Now, that's something any progressive will immediately understand. And it goes against everything that conservatives believe about taxation. You see it in Warren Buffett, who's an interesting guy. He just gave away $30 billion to charities. He said that if he had been dropped in Bangladesh 30 years ago, he would still be impoverished because they had no banking system and no stock market. That is, he didn't create the stock market. He didn't create the banking system. He's not a self-made man. He used the Commonwealth to gain his wealth. And he knows that, and he appreciates it, and he understands that he has to give that back in some form.
You're listening to an interview with George Lakoff, whose latest book is Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. Let me throw a couple of criticisms, and not really criticisms based upon what you're saying now, but they're, I think, mostly related to how others view your work rather than your work itself. One is from Thomas Frank. When I talked to him about this, his response was that Democrats have become corporate-based, let their real base behind, and that's one of the main reasons why they've lost support in places like the Midwest. They've lost their populist core because the Republicans and the DLC Democrats have the same economic view. The difference becomes the, quote, moral issues, and the Republicans can push those issues. Even if we reframe, to some degree, we're still caught because the DLC Democrats aren't that much different on economic issues.
He's not the only one saying this. By the way, I know and respect Thomas Frankfurt greatly and disagree with him on one issue, which we'll talk about. The same with David Sirota, whose book Hostile Takeover is, you know, a marvelous record of this. But they're wrong in one deep and important respect. And it's the same problem that you find with John Edwards, with Dan Greenberg's To America's book, and so on. They all say the same thing. They assume that what you need and can have is an economic populism. When you look at conservative populism, it does not work that way. By the way, the best description of conservative populism is in Thomas Frank's book. I mean, he's a superb anthropologist of Kansas. What you find there, especially if you look through the arguments and language used by conservative populists, is the following. There are three factors. First, they're usually lower to middle class conservatives. What makes them conservative? They have a strict father view of the family, and they apply it not just to the family, but to other parts of life in general and to the world. And they identify themselves that way. This is a deep identity. Second, they have a different view of causation. It turns out that conservatives, when they're arguing about causation, and progressives, view causation very differently. Conservatives view causation as direct, and liberals tend to view causation as systemic and complex. So if you say, what's the cause of crime? Conservatives say, bad people, lock them up. If you say, what's the cause of crime to liberals, they'll say, well, there's racism, there's poverty, there's lack of education, there's drug culture, etc. Okay? They will look for different kinds of causation. And this is completely systematic. There's a chapter of Whose Freedom that goes into this in detail. So what happens with conservative populism is, first, you have people who have a strict father view of the family that they identify with. They view this in terms of direct causation. And that means they do not accept the liberal views of what's right and wrong, and they do not accept the view of causation that is systemic. Thirdly, the most important part of this is they have been told by the leaders of the Republican Party for 40 years that they are being oppressed by liberals. There's the liberal elite, the tax and spend liberals, the Hollywood liberals, the latte liberals, etc., who are looking down their nose at them, thinking that they're stupid and uncultured, who are the liberal media control the facts, you know, etc. That's the idea.
Right. Is there much difference between that, let's say, and the way the Jews were used over in Europe for all those years?
There's certain things that are the same. The strict father morality is the same. That's true. The idea of scapegoating is the same. Some of the language is the same. The idea of oppression, you know, et cetera, is the same. But there's a much deeper and more complicated thing going on. The Jews were used as serious physical scapegoats with pogroms. There haven't been liberal pogroms. But liberals are seen as being the oppressors. And so if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, it's there constantly, or any of these guys on radio. And that's what makes them so angry. They're angry that these people are looking down at them and oppressing them. Now, the word that's used is liberty. Remember Goldwater, that extremism in defense of liberty is no vice? Right. Well, they're talking, if you go and look at Jerry Falwell's website, it's Liberty University, Liberty Council, Liberty this, Liberty that. The word liberty is used, you know, mainly these days in ordinary conversation by conservative populists. And this is a cultural issue. It's a matter of identity. It's not a matter of economics. And if you think you can just go in there and talk economics and change your economic policy, you're not going to change anything with these guys. Now, the question is, what could you do? And what you could do is actually somewhat interesting. If you understand that you have people who have both views, I call them biconceptuals. If you have people who have both views in different parts of their lives, and there are many conservatives who love the land, who are progressive Christians, honest business people, and so on, what you can do is, on the basis of those issues, try to convince them that they're actually being oppressed by conservatives, and start using the language of conservative oppression. Why do their kids have asthma, et cetera, because of conservative policies? Right? And this is something that one could do in many cases, and start there with those folks.
But the problem that would come up there is what you talk about later on in the book, which is the rationalist mistake, which is assuming that by arguing a particular position, people are going to logically think it through and go, oh, yeah, I agree with you.
No, that's not how you do it. You have to do it very much in the way that liberals were branded by conservatives. The way they were branded is through adjectives and modifiers. The limousine liberals, the latte liberals, the tax and spend liberals. These modifiers come with frames. And you're going to have to do the same thing with conservatives. And you're going to have to create the appropriate language of conservative oppression. And you're going to have to say it over and over for a long time all over the country, that you're going to have a network of people speaking out. And that's where the Rockridge Institute comes in. We're now about to put out our progressive handbook. It'll be published for $10 and given away free online, but it'll be cheaper to buy it than download it. It's everything you need to know about framing, but through that we also want to set up an online network of individual activists and groups around the country who want to use this tool and help us develop it better, ask questions about it, criticize it, etc., and help us do better with it. But also to constantly talk regularly about what progressive values are and to create and use an effective language of progressive thought.
George Lakoff, another objection, and again, it's not really an objection, comes from Mark Crispin Miller, who's written about the stolen 2000-2004 election. His view is that if the 2000 election was stolen, and if the 2004 election was stolen, and if elections in general in this country are stolen, that while he might agree with you about the framing idea, it's less important because we're getting ripped off anyway, and in fact, America does have more progressive values than the politics appears to show.
I don't disagree with that. We're both right. and not only that, it's very important to understand that you have to both change elections and change how people think.
Recently, I interviewed John Dean concerning his book, which is about authoritarians and authoritarianism on the right. It's his contention that conservatism, meaning whatever constitutes the conservative thought process as put forward by Barry Goldwater, has virtually disappeared and been replaced by authoritarians being authoritarian based upon research that has been done concerning the nature of authoritarian followers and leaders.
He's partly right. There are certain things he misses. I'm not arguing against the positive things he's saying, but let me try to show you the relationship between what he's doing and what I'm doing, which fit together very well. What he doesn't understand is this, that what Barry Goldwater called conservatism was what I'll call partial conservatism. That is, it was an application of strict father morality to certain domains but not others. So there were, for example, in Goldwater's day, many different kinds of conservatives. There were the Rockefeller-type conservatives, the fiscal conservatives. There were the libertarian conservatives. There were the strong defense conservatives. There were the religious conservatives. But what's interesting, he does talk about that, but they're all partial. What's new is, one, the addition of neoconservatives who apply this in a different way, strict father morality, in a quite different way to foreign policy. But what's new is the thoroughgoing conservative. And the thoroughgoing conservative applies strict father morality to all areas of life. They try to bring it together. So where you had before, you had libertarians who might be free market conservatives. or people who were strong defense against communism conservatives, but not social or religious conservatives. Those folks have been replaced by people who are conservative in all of those areas. What Dean saw as conservatism was actually partial application of a conservative worldview to certain areas, but not others. And the big thing that's changed is the application of strict father morality to governing itself. And that is where Dean just draws the line. He says, look, if you're governing the Republican Party or Congress or the government, you shouldn't be doing to them what you're doing in other areas of life, you know. But the same model that applies to foreign policy, that applies to, you know, to economic policy, that applies to religion, is now being used for governing itself. And that is what he calls authoritarianism. And he's right. It is authoritarian when it's applied to governing itself.
He also goes further and says 25% to 30% of the population, based upon these studies that these sociologists have done, are authoritarian followers. And then you've got the double high authoritarian leaders, where it's almost beyond what we would consider framing into personality types.
Framing and personality types are the same thing. What is personality? It's having a brain of a certain kind. If you get brain injuries, your personality can change. So what's called personality has to do with brain structure and what kinds of frames fit that brain structure best. It's not that they're not personality types. They are, but that's not separate from framing. Framing is not superficial. It's not spin. It's not just words. It's the deepest values that you have, and not just values, the deepest understanding of the world that you have.
So in a sense, what he's talking about for those 25 to 30% of the people are people who aren't bifurcated between nurturing parent and strict father.
Pretty much, yes. If you look at it in terms of electoral politics, you know, Bush's ratings are not going to go much below 35%. You know, that's your absolute base. And the same is true on the other side. I mean, you know, you're going to get roughly the same for progressives, absolute full progressives in every area, although each side will understand and know about the other. But then you have these folks who are in the middle, and in the middle doesn't mean issue by issue spread left to right. It means they're all over the place. They have strict father views in some areas of life and nurturant views of others, and they're mixed up.
George Lakoff, John Dean did have one problem with your books, which is he said you avoid footnote attribution. It's hard to find out where you get your information, particularly attribution to some of the research you have done, the field work.
There's plenty of attribution to all the books and all the studies and all the articles in there. And if you look at moral politics, for example, it is thoroughly documented. But it's not in footnote form. It's actually in the text. Little parentheses, and it says, see such and such, 1983A. Now, in Elephant, we didn't do footnotes for a couple of reasons. The book was written in 2 weeks, and one of the constraints on it was to drop out all academic stuff. So I gave them, you know, twice as much material, and they threw it away, and the publisher threw it away and said, this is too academic. You got too much academic apparatus and references. We want something ordinary people can read in their pockets. So that's what we gave them. And moral politics is there with all the footnotes and references you want. But that's not going to satisfy John Dean. When he means studies, he means something very different than what certain cognitive scientists mean studies. The kinds of studies done in the social sciences are very different from those done in the cognitive sciences. Now, cognitive science has many fields, and there are different kinds of studies. There are, if you're in experimental psychology, you run experiments. You don't go out and do surveys. There's a survey branch of this that does surveys, but that's very different and quite limited. Whereas if you're a sociologist, you do surveys and polls and things like that. You don't do experiments. And then the other part, if you're a cognitive linguist, you have vast data. Your job is to account for everything. That is, you have to account for not only all the uses of words that you hear, but all of the inferences, all the arguments, everything. And you have to be able to have a good ear at this to be able to do it. You have to go online. I go, for example, in Who's Freedom. There's lists of all the websites that we got these things from. There's lists of the articles, the books, etc. Long lists. But also, every time you turn on the TV, if you've got a conservative arguing, you've got to be able to account for his argument. And if you can't, then the first thing you do is your red flag goes up and say, whoops, we made a mistake, we didn't have this one. Whose Freedom was rewritten 6 times. And the reason for that is that the people I had read it and the people at the press who read it kept finding cases I hadn't covered. And I had to keep analyzing, and we went then, did more computer searches on Google and other ways to look at all the examples of freedom and liberty we could find to make sure we covered it. And it was only after we actually, kept looking and we couldn't find new cases that we stopped. Now, that's a vast amount of data. But it's not something where you can write down so-and-so on this TV show such-and-such, where you do it all the time. And you certainly don't write down the ones where he got it right. And you can't write down the ones where he didn't get it. You don't have George Bush arguing the other way. You don't have Dick Cheney arguing for welfare or for the United Nations. I mean, so the absence of certain things are things that you can count on. That's part of the methodology in the kind of work that we do. It's sort of overwhelming data methodology. It's what's called modeling. What you're trying to do is model people's minds. You're trying to model how people reason, how people understand language, how people think, and you're trying to get that right. And your models have to do with the formal structure of frames and the formal structures of metaphors.
It seems difficult, though, at a certain point, to keep your own projections out of it.
That's my job. If you get it wrong, you got it wrong. How can you be politically effective if you don't have the science right? It's my job to get it right.
If you do have it right, then, how do we maintain focus when suddenly Israel invades Lebanon?
It's a very interesting question, because the range of cases you've got to cover suddenly changes. I mean, it's a very different kind of case. What's going on with Israel and Lebanon right now is unprecedented in many ways. It doesn't fit any language that we currently have. Israel itself has been very, very bad in its PR. I mean, they made the mistake of hiring Frank Luntz. something they should never have done. Even if you believed in their strategy, which I think is a terrible, not only mistake, but an immoral act in many ways, but you could understand why it was done. It was done stupidly, and also their PR was done stupidly. But there isn't a word for what is going on there. There isn't a word to really describe what either side is doing, what either Hezbollah or Israel is doing. And that makes it difficult, because there are no pre-existing frames.
The right wing has been very good. One particular issue comes up about corruption, and suddenly, the terror rating goes up. It definitely changes the focus, and the media does what the media does.
Right. There's a separate issue. All right, manipulating the media is separate from framing. That is, framing can be used to manipulate in the case of spin. It can be used to manipulate in the case of Orwellian language. There are many ways to use framing to manipulate the media. Progressives want to use framing to tell the truth. So, for example, the fact that we have an occupation in Iraq, not a real war, where two armies are fighting over territory, that was over in 2003 when Bush stood on the carrier. We've had an occupation there, and that's the truth. It's a framing that is required in order to see the truth. And that's something that people don't understand. You require framing to see truth. And in cases where you see truth anyway, you may not see that you have framing there. A very good example of this is the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth. It was done very, very cleverly. The opening scene is a scene of a river where you are empathizing with the river, with the place. You're connecting with it. And what you're doing is evoking a nurturant morality. And that happens throughout. You have scenes that evoke a nurturant morality, which tell you how to evaluate what's being said and how to evaluate those facts. That movie is carefully framed, very, very carefully framed, and it's framed to allow you to see the truth. And the inconvenient, he says, an inconvenient truth, what is not framed as in the movie is what's inconvenient about it. What's not framed is the arguments of the companies who say it would cost them so much to do this and blah, blah, blah. Right? All sorts of arguments that say this is impractical, it's hard, it's whatever. Those are not there. Whatever is inconvenient is not in the movie. It's not in the frame. That's important because it would actually take away from the truth that's involved there. Now, there is a truth also that's hidden by the movie, which is, yes, it will be costly. Yes, certain, many changes would have to occur in people's, not only in people's behavior, but in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of how the government is run. You know, that's another part of the truth, and that's the inconvenience. But to see truth, you have to have framing all the time. Facts do not speak for themselves.
You use the term radical conservative. It itself is an oxymoron. Wouldn't it be better to talk about radical right wing, for instance?
I do both.
I've stopped using the word conservative myself. These people aren't conservative.
Well, I talk about this a bit in the book. You're right. The word conservative suggests that you're conserving something, and they're not. I mean, the actual traditional values of freedom in this country are progressive values, as I point out at the very beginning. And they're not trying to conserve them, they're trying to overturn them. So they are radicals in this regard. They're radical right-wingers, they're fundamentalists, and so on. All true. But they call themselves conservatives, and that word has come to mean something different than, what it meant before. It's what is called polysemous. It has two senses. And there are times, for the sake of identification, that it's more appropriate to use the word conservative, and in other cases, it's more appropriate to say right-wing or radical right. And I try to modify conservative to radical conservatives. Now, there's a book coming out on radical conservatism. And I think it's important to understand that the word conservative has just changed. But it's not the case that traditional Goldwater conservatives were conservative either. John Dean is not exactly right on that area. The traditional Goldwater conservatives were radicals in certain areas.
But not in others.
But not in others.
In terms of frames, let me throw two things out at you and tell me, are these frames specifically? One is the right wing tends to talk about environmentalism as if it's a wacky religion, not a science. Is that a frame?
Yeah.
Okay. And the other is dealing with Lamont versus Lieberman, that Lamont is a product of bloggers versus, say, the idea that Lieberman is an appeaser.
Both are framings, and both are attempts to use spin. Neither is an attempt to tell the truth.
One thing I've noticed is that the right wing is very good at grabbing onto stuff. Political correctness, I first heard about it in 1992 or 3 when Philip Maldery of KPFA made the comment, "That's not PC," and we both laughed. It was a left-wing joke. Somehow the right wing got hold of it and turned it into a political tornado.
Actually, I first heard of it in 1979. From an undergraduate who had gotten it from her father, who was a conservative.
But they've taken it and run with it.
They've run with it, and they put it in the context of conservative populism. That is, PC, politically correct for conservatives, it means the view of liberals who are oppressing conservatives. It's the view that liberals have that don't make any sense to conservatives at all because they have a different worldview, and that liberals are trying to impose on them.
George Lakoff, once I talked with Roger Ebert, and he told me that he was getting letters back for each of his reviews, and he said it was fascinating. The left-wing letters were all these reasoned 5 or 6 page diatribes detailing every reason why he was wrong. The right-wing ones were, "To hell with you, fat guy."
Yes.
And there's something deeper there going on.
Yes, and I think that's right. there's a tradition on the left of rationalism, and that's again discussed in this book. Rationalism is a philosophy that arose in the 17th century. This country was founded on the basis of Enlightenment thought. It was viewed at the time that everybody was rational, that what made you a human being was your rationality, and that meant that everybody had the same rationality because we're all equally human. And it was also assumed that rationality had certain properties. One, that it was not physical, that it was separate from the body. Right? We know from cognitive science that is absolutely false. Secondly, that it was conscious. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, because he was conscious, right? Turns out most of your thought is not conscious, right? Utterly false. Third, it's assumed that it is works by logic, by kind of like Aristotelian logic. False, that we were think in terms of frames and metaphors. Fourth, it's assumed to just fit the world directly as if there were no frames or metaphors, and therefore frames and metaphors can just be language and things to confuse people and so on. Right? Utterly false, again. And then it has the conclusion that if you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion. Absolutely false, because the first four are false. And that's the problem. Liberals have inherited a rationalist tradition, and they assume that if they just give people rational arguments, and they assume also that their understanding of the world is neutral, that they don't have frames, that they don't have metaphors, that they are understanding the world just as it is. A very good example of this is Alan Wolf in the Washington Monthly recently had an article about why conservatives can't govern. Well, they're against government. They're not against all government. They're only against government that has social programs. They're for government with a military, government that has subsidies for corporations, government that gives away resources of the public, government that, you know, does all sorts of other things. You know, it's not that they're against government. And in those cases, they're actually very effective. They've been winning constantly. And from their perspective, governing effectively. But not from our perspective. But how can he say that? Because he's a rationalist. He assumes that his views are the literally true views.
And in fact, everybody's operating from different frames. They're seeing things different ways, which is what your book, Whose Freedom, is about, George Lakoff.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with George Lakoff, whose latest book is Whose Freedom? The Battle Over America's Most Important Idea. Also, a handbook. What's the title of that?
It's called Thinking Points. It's a progressive handbook.
Available both in bookstores and online.
End of September.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.